From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. Nice to be with you again. One of the grand challenges for social work is harnessing technology for social good. And a lot of people really like and are engaged by games. A podcast is born. Fun, rewards, challenge, feedback, goals, and measurable progress. A pretty novel and aspirational way to experience and view effective interventions for clients. Early literature suggests that these experiences are welcomed by consumers of mental health services and that there's wide acceptance of incorporating gamification into treatment experiences. Gamification is entering the therapeutic mainstream and increasingly being utilized in new options for mental health treatment and intervention. Today's guest, Dan Kelly, LCSW, has parlayed his long-term interest in video games into adding increasing gamification into his clinical social work practice. Mr. Kelly will tell us about his career trajectory with gamification and speak about how he utilizes games as therapeutic tools to help his clients develop strengths, new skill sets, and achieve their goals. He'll explain how he fuses and refines evidence-based practices with video games and virtual reality, and assess some of the challenges facing clinicians who want to learn more about these creative interventions. Dan Kelly, LCSW, is a social worker in private practice at GameWave Mental Health Services in Pleasant Grove, Utah. He's also a 2017 graduate of the UB School of Social Work. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Social Work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
All right. I'm very eager to get going, but I'm going to kind of try and control myself here. And I make it a habit of asking our guests two things. If they're social workers, I know you're a social worker. I ask them, you know, how they kind of found their way to social work. Usually the avenues are kind of interesting. And then I'm going to ask you, like, how you came to our topic for today, your interest in technology and therapy and gamification and virtual reality and all the things we're going to talk about today. But if we could, can you give us like the quick ride through how you found your way to social work?
Yeah, sure. You know, if you asked me that question when I first got into the field, I would have said it kind of happened by chance.
An MSW application just dropped out of the ceiling and you were that's fair.
At the time when I was in undergrad, I found myself needing to find an adjacent major that accept my credits. So I decided to go with health and human services, community mental health, and I needed two internships to graduate from that.
Yeah.
One was exploring universal design yoga with Susan Mandolce.
Gotcha.
It was cool. I learned the power of mind body connection and resilience. And I met an author and the yoga instructor who's Matt Sanford. His work was foundational to universal design yoga. And you know, his story was a transformative experience of learning to live with paralysis from the waist down after an accident at 13. It was nothing short of incredible. And on the last day of my internship, I had the privilege of taking him on a tour around campus and going out to lunch with him one-on-one. And he gifted me a simple truth that I believe had quite an impact on me that led me down this path towards social work. And it was the power of stories and being seen. We sat down for lunch and he asked me, he said, Dan, tell me a story. I'm not going to remember your name if you don't tell me a story.
Yep.
And so I told him my story. And that was a incredible experience. The other internship, so it came down to crunch time to find one, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I was randomly introduced to clinical and child psychologist Dr. Drew Messer, and he asked me what was going on in my life. And when I told him my dilemma, he offered to take me on as an intern, like right there.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, So I interned with him at his private practice, Electronic Gaming Therapy Inc.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. It's
Yeah.
all coming together.
Yep. And so there I was introduced to the craft of video games being implemented into therapy. And he fused it with a model of social information processing that he and his colleague, Dr. Brian Moyer, and his wife, Liz, who's also a social worker, they developed and refined this. And then they fused the two together with video games and this beautiful therapeutic process that was used in so many different ways. And I shadowed them and participated in individual, family, group therapy sessions for a couple of years. And at some point, Drew asked me, he said, if you could play video games for a living and help people, would you do it? I was like,
Is that a rhetorical question?
I was like, yeah. And so began my journey into this awesome field of mental health. And that's the story I've told myself and other people when they ask me that question, how I got into this. Now looking back on my life, it's all too apparent. My life experiences, my traumas, the hardships I've faced, the roles and the relationships and with friends and family, the support I had, the Jewish community being raised in that, and the sports teams, my growth, my successes, my love for video games, all of that, it's clear to me I didn't just fall into this line of work. This was my calling, man.
And your love of music.
Oh yeah. Oh
Viewers
yeah.
cannot see this, but Dan's sitting in a room where there are a half a dozen guitars and a keyboard, and I can't see what else. That might be it, but that's quite enough. So, well,
Oh,
th thanks, Dan. Thanks for
yeah.
laying that. It's great how these stories always make perfect sense in hindsight. But in the moment, it at least for me, it sometimes felt like floundering, but it was not. It all somehow comes together. So thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Are
Never the
you
path.
ready for the chat?
Oh, yeah. I'm
Let's
ready for
do it.
this.
So we're planning on talking about gamification and therapy and the use of virtual reality. But especially for people like me, I think it would be helpful to lay out the kind of the playing field a little bit and just talk about a couple of definitions so we're all on the same page. So I want to start by just asking you if you had to define gamification, for me, how would you do that?
Yeah, sure.
Although I think I kind of know what it is, but let's see. Let's see.
I'll start general and then dive into therapy. So in general, gamification is it's taking elements of game design and applying it to the human experience that lies outside the virtual world or the general arenas of play. It's a pretty versatile term, and I say that because depending on how you conceptualize it or how you're talking about it, which I'm willing to bet is greatly influenced by whatever field you're in, whether it's education, medical field, mental health, social work, psychology, business, marketing, social media, whatever. Gamification can be a perspective, an action, a technique, a strategy, a process, a design framework for a system. No matter how gamification's being used, thought about, or discussed, the common denominator there—it's a—it's this umbrella. It's this—the purpose of increasing motivation and engagement to influence or change behavior with the aim of achieving a particular outcome you have in mind. So, that's general. Now, going into therapy, like I define gamification as the art of taking elements of game design and bringing them to the client's outside world for application and practice of new skills.
So let me, if I could, I may ask a number of silly questions, so this could be the first of them. So When I think about this, now I haven't done this, so that's what everybody should know. I'm asking about things that I literally haven't done, and I'm not a gamer per se. I've watched, I have adult children. I remember watching them do this stuff, but I remember I just couldn't even hit the ball on a baseball game, and I just said, all right, enough of this. So when it comes to therapy, you mentioned motivation. I can see how that would mo how that might motivate people to even try therapy. But also, doesn't the game itself attempt to increase the participants' motivation by adding, I guess what I have in my head is that you win prizes, accumulate points, and things like that. Am I thinking about this correctly? I am. Holy cow. Okay.
So when it comes to game designers, they're incredible, man.
I believe you.
I was looking at years ago when I first started getting into this, I found these guys, Granite Global and the Angles. They had this article on the benefits of video games, and they talked about game designers, and they described them, and I'll take a quote from that. They said, game designers have mastered the art of pulling people of all ages into virtual environments, having them work toward meaningful goals, persevere in the face of multiple failures, and celebrate the rare moments of triumph after successfully completing challenging tasks. And they use failure as motivational tools and provide only intermittent chances of large success, large scale successes. And these are the kind of intermittent reinforcement schedules that are most effective for training new behaviors. And game designers, so I looked a lot into game designers in the deep dives that I've done into the literature and the research and podcasts and even master classes. They talk about how the big portion of this, when they're creating a game, they're looking at player psychology. They call it player-centered, which, I'm thinking client-centered, right? And they're using psychological concepts almost religiously. You're looking at games that are fueled by things like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They're using operant conditioning. You have times where they're looking, they use Freud's theories of personality, and they're doing it well.
Like we should be surprised about that.
And so, yeah, they aim to have players, that they want the players to do certain things. And they also understand that players are not going to do what they're intending for them to do. And they work with, and they're working with sound designers to, evoke particular emotions that they're trying to do these things. And it's wild what they've accomplished together.
Yeah, interesting. So in setting up the definitions, I kind of separated gamification and virtual reality. And that's not probably the most accurate way to think about it, right? They're intertwined, I'm assuming.
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the nuance around virtual reality for folks who aren't clear what that might mean, and even an application of the kind of the therapy world that you're discussing?
Sure. So, virtual reality, I'd say it's cutting edge technology that falls under the umbrella of extended reality, or XR. It's a headset that allows us to step into a three-dimensional computer-generated world or environment that's interactive and controllable.
Interactive and controllable.
It's very immersive, and it provides this profound sense of presence. Despite you knowing that you're in a virtual world or just playing a game, the level of immersion, the presence and embodiment, it's so powerful. Your brain thinks what you're experiencing is real. And you know, that comes with real thoughts, real feelings, real behaviors. And there's so much valuable information in that, even diagnostic information that we can gather when working with clients in these virtual spaces.
Okay, so we're going to get to some of this because this is where I think it gets really interesting. I have to admit, when we first started to dabble with this stuff here at UB, you know, we were playing with the what is it, the little cardboard box that you put over your glasses. That was actually kind of okay. I was surprised how okay it was, quite frankly. But then when you got the headset, now you're cooking with gas. So I do have some sense of what you're talking about. So you told us a little bit about when you moved toward video games and gamification and VR and kind of how you got there. But I do want to spend some time talking about what you actually do because I know a little bit. I know that you Yeah, if you could tell us about like what you're doing, you know, recently. I know that you were working in like residential settings, I believe, and then you moved into to private work. So if you could tell us a little bit about what you actually do, and then what I really want to talk about is how, you know, you work with trauma and how you combine established therapeutic models into what you're doing. So let me stop talking and get you talking about what is, tell us what you do and then how you've like integrated some of these ideas.
Yeah, sure. So, I can start. I'll start with kind of like just like an outline of what I'm currently doing. And then,
Okay.
I think it's important to also talk about how I got here, more in
Okay.
more detail,
Go
because
ahead.
this has been evolving. And, I think it's helpful when clinicians get, especially those who are just coming into the field, get to see like the evolution of how this can work for them and their theoretical perspectives. So right now, in individual therapy, I'm using video games to do to strengthen the therapeutic alliance. Building rapport, gathering that relevant information through play, video game chats, or enhancing the case formulations, right? And I'm doing strength-based approaches in this: cognitive behavioral therapy, schema therapy, trauma therapy with trauma focused CBT, trauma narratives, exposure therapy, and even EMDR. And with families, I'm looking at strengthening relationships, patterns of communication, the dynamics, and groups. Now that I'm in private practice, I haven't been doing groups in a while. But I was aiming when I was doing the groups, I was aiming at developing social competence, emotional intelligence, communication skills, motion regulation skills, impulse control, problem solving skills development, that kind of stuff. You asked me, like how I'm doing this, right?
Yeah, like literally in the most practical sense. And you know, if you can, you know, on the fly, eventually maybe tell us a story about how maybe a specific case or a situation that I think that'd be wonderful.
When I was doing work with Dr. Messer, I was doing gamification. I just didn't know it.
Okay.
And it wasn't until after grad school that I was thinking about it. I was like, man, there's gotta be more ways to do this. The way I was taught was a very structured approach. He would always say the video game isn't the therapy. The therapy is the therapy. And there's truth in that, absolutely. And it would come, we would do the hard work first, and then we'd transition to games, and there would be interventions within the gameplay itself. But I had to find something else. There was more out there, and so I started digging, and I found it was actually this podcast series that I found my first gold mine. you guys did an interview in 2014 with social worker Mike Langlois, and I really liked what he had to say. And so I looked into him a bit. I saw that he had a book, Reset, Psychotherapy and Video Games. And I got like a quarter way through that book before I said, all right, I gotta reach out to this guy. And I started, even before I did, I actually started, tinkering around with some of the things that he was saying. And I kind of hit this wall in a way. And so when I reached out to him, I asked him a question. I found him in LinkedIn. I sent him a message. And I was like, hey, I'm working with teenagers at a residential treatment facility, and I'm, like partway through your book, and I'm finding the most games that my kids would play consist of like default characters. And I went into that because he talks about avatars and characters and how they can be harnessed in therapy. I explains, with one of my kids, I attempted exploring how he might be similar or different from Bruce Wayne, Batman. And I was met with some hesitation to explore the topic, in addition to him having some difficulty multitasking, talking and playing. So I was wondering, how might you approach barriers such as this? And his first response, he said, I actually just brought it up. He goes, I think the barrier here, as I see it, is in the therapist rather than
Oh,
the patient. Winky
wow.
face.
Yeah. Ooh. All right. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had that experience. Wow. Good.
Oh
All right.
yeah. And so he went into something pretty important. He was talking about how, we therapists, we often have the we put pressure on ourselves to have therapy be talking rather than play, because we're dedicated to the evidence-based practice and making sure that we're articulating that something meaningful is happening in session.
Sure.
And he shared some of his experience to outline a concept he talks about in his book, unnecessary obstacles, which is really huge if you're going to understand gamification. That's understanding unnecessary obstacles is key. And I found this to be very helpful and validating. And then he asked me a super meaningful question that I'd like to ask you.
Oh, okay, here we go.
Yeah, here we go. He said, so the question is, what comes up for you internally when you consider playing the whole session, engaged fully in the play, and being with the patient or client playfully?
And what was the beginning of the question? I'm sorry, what comes up in me?
What comes up for you internally when you consider doing this?
Internally, let's see. Well, I like it. I haven't been a practitioner now for over 20 years. So I spent 16 years as a practitioner, and I worked with kids and families. And I, you know, that was a different world, I think, in many ways. I'm not sure Pong was out yet. I didn't see how I could talk to young children, especially in a meaningful way. I just knew that a lot of what I learned was not really built for them. So we would play. You know, I had a hoop, we would shoot baskets. If the child made the basket, we called it the control game. If the child made the basket, the kid would be able to tell me something that I had to do within reason, like dance or jump up and down. If I made the basket, and we talked, so I liked playing with kids. You know, there was the high tech back then, Dan, was a game called the Talking, Feeling, Doing game. It was like a card game with dice, but I imagine it's much cooler now. So I like it. I enjoy it. But I have to admit, even then, my inclination was to think, is this helpful? Or am I doing professional work, or am I just hanging out with this kid and having fun? So I have to admit that I liked it, but I did wonder, and sometimes I'm sure I held back from my supervision what was going on during my sessions with younger children and adolescents, to be honest with you. Did I
Yeah.
answer the question?
Yeah. You
Okay, all
did a
right.
great job.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's so, both like, yeah, this is, I can see this. This is exciting. This sounds great. And also, what are we doing here? Is this actually helping? Right.
It's fun. Is this supposed to be fun?
Yeah. So it's a thought-provoking question, right? It's beautifully designed, and for me, it helped me lift this curtain, like allowing me to access parts of me that were surfacing during sessions while learning this stuff, and causing interference that to me were hindering the therapeutic process
Yeah,
and my
I get
clinical
Mike's point
development.
completely now, his statement, sure.
And like. I a few years back, I worked with a psychologist who, expressed intrigue toward, how I was using video games and VR therapy. He shared curiosity and concern. He was like, he's great at metaphors and analogies. He goes, it's the way I see it, it's kind of like when you're getting a massage and you're on your belly and your face is inside the hole in the bench. And right when you're getting into it, some guy pokes his head underneath right in your face and says, "Hey, let's talk about your feelings."
Yeah, there you go.
And I felt like I was doing that, like that. That's it, and it felt weird. It
That's a
felt like
good
it.
story.
Is this actually doing anything? It's a very valid point, and I did that a lot when I first got into this, and I learned that behavior, it's an extension of my own unnecessary obstacles, my own transference, the guilt of having fun, the anxiety and the pressure to do the work and show that I'm doing it.
Exactly.
So going back to that, that kid that I brought up that question to him. I thought about it more seriously, and I acknowledged what was going on for me, and I decided to try this out, try it again. This kid had been labeled, difficult, right? And this was at a residential treatment facility, and outside myself, he probably got along with, I don't know, maybe zero people, we've been working together for, quite a few months up to that point. And so he opted to play Batman, Arkham City again. And, rather than try to force the talk and the questions and all that, I decided to engage fully in the play. And it was uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
It was very uncomfortable, but I was present with him and to the best of my ability and what he was doing. And the first thing I noticed, he never used stealth to defeat his enemies. He went looking for brawls. And to me, that was interesting because, Batman, the world's greatest detective, turns out he's pretty stealthy, strategic. And that in the game, it tries to steer you in that direction a lot of using stealth. But he was just going in. Fist raised, ready to go, dropping into enemies of like 10 bad guys. And then I started seeing another pattern because he did this a few times, and I picked up on he would go into the into this he dropped down into this group of enemies, and he would start mashing the hit button, punch and kick. And there's a button that's a counterattack button where you get like this kind of like spidey sense above your head, and it tells you, hey, you're about to get clocked. Counter now or you're toast. And he didn't. Every single time he'd be punch, punch, kick, kick, gets hit in the face. Punch, punch, kick, 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 punch, 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 boom. Over and over and over again. And I said, hey, man. So I noticed every time you're dropping into the enemies, you're doing great getting the hits in, and you're choosing not to block or counterattack when you're about to get hit. I'm curious about that. And he said, I don't care how badly I get hurt, as long as I hurt them first. And I let that sink in for a minute, and that line, I realized, like, wait, hold on a second. This was parallel to what we were seeing on the unit. during times of conflict and the aggressive outbursts with both peers and staff. He'd get that sense, that real or perceived threat sense, and instead of trying to get around that and avoid it in some way, he would go at him first, usually verbally. This fear-based action. And of course, my interpretation could be off. I don't truly know what's exactly going on here, or if it holds meaning at all. And the only way of knowing is to explore it. But I put what he said and I was thinking into my back pocket for now, right? I just kept watching him play. And that was the first session that he left smiling, excited, making jokes. But I couldn't help myself, man. As I'm walking him back to his unit, I brought it up while it was fresh. Not the right time to do it. Anyways, I said, "Hey, man, I was thinking about what you said earlier, and I'm wondering if that thought plays out in other areas of your life." And he paused. He looked at me with this smirk, wagged his finger at in my face, and was like, I see what you're doing." And he closed the door on my face with a smile, and then just laughed as he went back onto the unit. And so
Wonderful,
that experience,
wonderful
it taught
interaction.
me if right, it was beautiful. It taught me a few things. Like one, he reciprocated organically, because we're talking about what he's doing. I didn't feel like I was having to, pry anything out of him. We were present together. He provided me valuable information about his internal world, and I learned that he wasn't ready to dive into that just yet. More rapport was needed for that kind of conversation. But looking in hindsight, I actually could have missed something. I could have actually had it all wrong. What if, the reason for the button mashing of just the hit, like I don't care how badly I get hurt, as long as I hurt them first. What if that wasn't accurate? What if that behavior that was indicative of lower cognitive functioning was actually because he just simply decided to blow through the game
That's
tutorial?
right. Yeah. That's the beauty of the
What?
game, right? You get hit,
Right?
but it doesn't really hurt, right?
Like in that case, if that was the case, like why would he choose to do that? What are we looking at,
Exactly.
to satiate immediate gratification? Is that a learning disability? Are we perhaps delusions of grandeur? Like there's so many things that could have been, and the only way to actually figure that out
But
is to have that conversation.
exactly. But isn't it fair, Dan, also to say that if, back in my practice days, if we were playing a game, or if I was drawing with a child or something, anything that would, I would look at drawings and I'd look for patterns and sequences and themes. And I don't really see this as profoundly different, but I see it as really client-centered. And also, it's like the classic social work, meet them when they're at. I mean, if the kid digs the game, play the game and let him tell the story. That's what makes a good game, doesn't it? I don't know a lot about this, but a lot of the games have like ongoing stories, right? And options about which way to take it. It's just a wonderful idea. That's a great story. Very encouraging. What you just did, and what you also, I know when we were trying to talk you into doing the podcast, we chatted very briefly, and what I learned is that you don't necessarily use games designed by therapeutic types, or these kind of games that have been manufactured or developed specifically for therapeutic purposes. Although you have, I think, but you find that there's maybe even greater utility and application in using the games that are popular and off the shelf and built for so-called, I don't know, entertainment, if you will. Could you say a little bit about that?
You're remembering correctly. I started with a commercial off-the-shelf games. And there was a point a few years ago where I tried a mental health specific VR headset that was specifically designed for exposure therapy and developing
Gotcha.
coping skills. And I was pretty impressed with its capabilities and its design. It was pretty sweet. It came with this device that could monitor the client's what was going on physiologically. Like after sessions, the software that came with it, it would produce a report, and it showed me, what was happening with the client's heart rate and when. It also showed me, like it provided like a heat signature map for where the client was looking in that session. So I could see, where the client's eyes were being gravitated to, and like, that would spark conversation. Like I was looking at the door because I just wanted to get out, right? And it was really cool, but after about 9 months, I recognized that the commercial games, they were a far greater asset for me and the work that I do. What it came down to is variety and options and what's financially reasonable. Only a handful of clients wanted to use that approach in therapy. Those that did choose that, they ended up changing their minds at some point for various reasons. And the headset started collecting dust. So to me, in general, I see these tools as investments in myself and my clients. However, if it's going to be super expensive and nobody's utilizing it, then it didn't feel like a right fit for me. So, if I wanted to just like hone my skills and market myself as someone who specializes in exposure therapy using that particular software to do the work, then, it might have been worth it. But that's just not how I want to roll as a clinician. It's not my style because, like, overall, I feel mental health specific games are more confining and they limit clients and therapists and their options to do this kind of work.
But even like maybe some of our old approaches and the limits we put on ourselves, right? That you were referring to earlier. So sorry, but you just rang a bell for me and I couldn't let that pass. Go ahead.
It's so like in the spirit of being trauma informed, I like providing my clients with options, offering games and apps that are familiar or exciting to them, options of doing therapy using, or if they want to do something more traditional without games, let's do that. You don't want to put a headset on, cool. There are plenty of people who in the work that we did, they didn't want to use VR because the fear, covering your eyes, trust issues, that kind of thing. And so, the work would be gravitating to, hey, maybe we find a way for readiness for that at some point. How do we get to that point where you can put the headset on? But yeah, people like to do fun games that they're into over this mental health specific thing.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I can't imagine that with young people, adolescents, children, that working with a social work type or social worker proper, that to meet a social worker who's fluent in the games, who's fluent in the lingo, and who clearly values it as something important, goes a long way toward building rapport and a certain degree of familiarity and trust. I mean, I'm jealous in many ways.
Well, I think you're right. And I also think, not only, it's very helpful to have like that all, that connection's already there. I think what's even more important, if you don't have that connection, if the therapist is curious and puts the kid into the teacher position and has them teach them about games or a specific game, watches YouTube videos with them, talks about it, learns from this kid, that also will fuel the relationship just as well.
Yeah, what a great. And that's pretty much how I have learned almost everything about technology by asking people who to show me and to do it, and kind of much like we're doing here today. So that's just perfect. So I don't know a lot about this. So I'm just going to throw this out and have you agree and elaborate or just fix my perception. But what little, I haven't read a ton of the literature on gamification, but I have a little. And I see some pretty good outcomes for especially VR. I think most of them were VR, and it's around depression and anxiety. You know, we don't have great outcomes with that with our traditional methods, so that's great to see that it's distinctly different and better for some people. There are concerns that there's so much diversity, I think, of how people do it, that you know, putting together right now a whole bunch of studies is probably not the best way to do it. And of course, exposure therapy seems, in the VR world, that just seems like a no-brainer even to somebody like me. What are the other, like, are there limits to the applications? Are there the greatest hits of using this side of technology?
You know, that's a really good question. Are there limits? Yes, there are absolutely limits. And I think the limits are very much aligned with the clinician's training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are things that can be done in VR that I don't know how to do because I'm not trained in that particular modality.
Mm-hmm.
I have a story.
Okay, go.
And this may cross over that question, but this is this story is my transition into VR in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a VR headset, and I had a weekend with my kid. And, you know, we just had a blast that weekend. We're using the Force as untrained Jedi in a game called Vader Immortal, controlling to defeat our enemies in a game called Super Hot VR. You know, we're controlling time to do that, and exploring the coolest places on Earth in an app called Wander, which is like Google Earth, only you are immersed there. You are in it.
Mm-hmm.
And after playing Super Hot for a few minutes, it kind of hit me. It was like, dude, this is the epitome of impulse control. Hold on a second. And then within 30 minutes of enjoying exploring the Earth, just going different places, you know, I had a holy moment. It's like, I can take my clients anywhere.
Wow.
I can go back to the coolest places they've been, the worst memories they've had, the fond memories for trauma, mm-hmm. for trauma processing, for building rapport, for getting just kind of like a sneak peek preview into, you know, their life. Because, you know, when someone tells me a story, I fabricate whatever it is that I see. And, you know, if I'm seeing a kid, I've had a kid who told me their story and I worked them for months, and like, I envisioned like this impoverished home, and that wasn't the case at all. I go back to work like the next week, and I had to try this out. I discussed my idea with one of my clients at the residential facility I was working at, who's aiming towards trauma processing. And I was open with him. He was like, to my knowledge, you know, there's no research out there of professionals exploring the fusion of this headset, this app, and interventions for trauma processing specifically like this.
Mm-hmm.
I let him know that there is research on VR exposure interventions, and that he would be the first person I ever worked with to try this out, and that this would be new for me. And he was all for it.
Mm-hmm.
He really wanted to get the work done. And so we decided to try this out, you know, the next session. So during the last 5 minutes of this session, I figured, let's be proactive. I had him find a nearby spot a few blocks away from the site where he survived a gang shootout so that we wouldn't waste time finding it next session, right? He found a familiar spot on the map that seemed nearby and he clicked on it and boom, he spawned right on the spot of the scene of where the incident happened. And his body trembled for a moment, and then he just rocketed into fight or flight. And we're talking raw amygdala, hypothalamus, lizard brain activation here. And, I was late for my next appointment. That was the moment I realized, don't do that. That's not proactive. That's a risk. And we tried using a container method to get back to baseline, but that didn't work. Mental imagery was not realistic at that moment. I didn't have EMDR Prime in my toolkit for desensitization to bring him back down. I didn't know what to do. And then I had an idea. I suggested to do the container method through Minecraft. Are you familiar with Minecraft?
I am. That's why I made a noise because it's one of the few that I know about. I watched it played and used endlessly in my own household. Yes. Not me though.
That's a
Which
shame.
I now regret, but anyway.
Man, you're trying to develop those executive functions, go for it, man. He was in agony, right? Cycling through these flashbacks. And so we tried tracking out this we tried building his container in the sandbox, Minecraft. And my thinking was, games have been found to temporarily alleviate symptoms of anxiety and depression during gameplay and capable of assisting them with returning to baseline. And my other thinking was, if he makes his container, then later on he might have more success of being able to access his container because rather than creating a mental image from scratch, he'll have an actual memory to fall back on.
Something visceral, yeah.
And so, he was open to that, gave it a shot. And within a few minutes, his breathing slowed down to a normal heart rate. His body followed suit. His face slacked. He was, concentrated on what he was doing, left brain activation, right? And if I remember correctly, he wasn't able to complete his container that session, but he returned to his unit feeling much better. And so, in that session, I learned, I greatly misjudged his readiness for that level of exposure. And yeah, he wanted to process his trauma, and we're able to meet. And we are to meet the client where they're at. And, he contracted for informed consent, but did we do enough resourcing, develop the skills adequate for being able to ground? No. And I realized I needed to examine myself a bit here. The internal things that may have contributed to obstructing my better clinical judgment. And aside from that examination, I also reflected on perhaps it's a good idea to consider proximity as part of the exposure process. Lean into it, dip our toes into the water first, see how it feels. The following session, we continued working on that container. First activated his trauma response, verbally, through guiding, and then we completed his build. It looked like a treasure chest. And had a glass floor and lava underneath, and I encouraged him to tell me about it, and it was detailed, thoughtful, creative, and it held meaning for him. And because the Minecraft approach was pretty effective at assisting grounding and returning back to baseline from fight or flight, we both had a level of confidence towards trying to trying the exposure again, and we had some work to do first. And so the day came that he stated and demonstrated readiness to re-enter the VR headset again.
Now, are you still at the facility and this still in residential?
Yes,
Okay, go ahead.
yes.
Sorry.
Right. So this next time we went in, he lasted like 10 more seconds before he had to take the headset off again. That was progress. And so we continued, returning to the scene of the incident. And I say, I say we, because I could see everything he could see through a projector. And as he went, and we also had been on our preparation up to that point, we were also creating the trauma narrative. And he would show me where he was and describe the detail of how things happened. And this was challenging for me because my brain, very visual and imaginative as it is, I already fabricate scenarios and narratives of traumas and clients' traumas when they're sharing their stories with me. And now I'm actually at the scene of the crime, like a detective walking through a red tape and observing the aftermath of the horrors that took place there. My brain is now putting the pieces together in a way that's more immersed than simply my own mental imagery. I'm there. And so, and I learned I'm willingly inviting a higher likelihood of vicarious trauma. And so when I'm doing this, it's paramount I ensure that I'm prepared for that kind of work. Being mentally prepared, emotionally prepared, doing what I can to make sure that my window of tolerance is at an optimal level, getting enough sleep, eating enough, compartmentalizing these, having those skills primed and ready, things like that. As we went through this, every single time we'd go in, he would add a little bit to his container, more detail. And, each session he was able to increase the amount of time that he was exposed to this trauma in this virtual environment. And there came a time where he, later down the road, he transitioned from traditional mental imagery and was able to successfully ground on his own. And it very much felt like the use of Minecraft was kind of like training wheels to get that, to actually achieve that that skill.
That's a really authentic and really helpful story. Thanks, Dan. And good for you too, actually. Good for you to remain open to learning like in real time. We could all use that kind of inspiration. So we are beginning to feel the tyranny of the, well, I'm feeling the tyranny of the clock. And we knew this was going to happen, right? We predicted this, but I do want to see if I can get you to talk. And you might feel that you have covered this already, but I can imagine that we're going to have some folks listening to this who are kind of like in my learning curve, or who have way more experience than I do, but don't know how to translate in this into a therapeutic application. Do you have any advice or encouragement for people who want to learn more about this? And I know you followed a path that was both you took initiative with, and it was also somewhat serendipitous. But if you could, could you advise people who want to learn more and get better, or do you simply encourage them to play games themselves, especially if they haven't?
First, I mean, you got every reason to be cautious. That's important. And I encourage you to take note from Yoda's book and be prepared to unlearn what you have learned. There's a lot of misinformation out there, whether it's media, personal experiences that, finds its way into our psyche. Listen to podcasts. Read the literature and the research critically. Don't take it at face value. Look at the collective works. Be mindful of authors' biases. Be intentional. Start with contemplating your own theoretical foundation as a clinician, the methods of intervention that you're trained in, the things that you see as agents of change. And check in on yourself too when you're going through this material. Notice if you find yourself seeking out, if you're just seeking out the benefits, or if you're gravitating towards the reasons for caution and limitations and whatnot, beware of your own biases and truths. And look outside the realm of mental health. I know my understanding of this stuff skyrocketed when I started looking at game designers, sound designers, and the gaming industry itself. Even though seeing that, like, that
The big
information.
picture.
Yes, and there's plenty of biases out there, but there's also a lot of valuable information that's very helpful. And so, if you know that already that you're wanting to do this stuff, There are people now doing CEU trainings on this.
I wondered, yeah.
And I very recently came across some of those. And that's exciting.
Yeah.
Do one, see how you like it. Find other clinicians who are doing this, doing it well.
Yeah.
Reach out to them, even if it's for just like a brief informational interview. Just seek supervision from an expert who's doing this. Talk cases.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say earlier. I mean, in most cases, this is always helpful, but especially in this, it sounds like having a trusted and open-minded supervisor who's invested in your professional development, not just
Yes.
your administrative adherence, if you
Yes.
will, would be
Yes.
a wonderful idea. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. I learned a lot, and it was quite engaging. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast. I really appreciate it.
It was.
Thanks again to Dan Kelly for joining us. The team answering the call of duty to produce the In Social Work podcast is Steve Sturman, our all things tech guru, Ryan Trofe, our GA production assistant, and I'm Peter Sabota. We'll see you again in 2 fortnights, everybody.